from New York City, theater and performance art impresario Mark Russell, next on The Culture Catch.
Paperwork, you're my brother, my sister too. And if you don't watch out, you know they're gonna get you too. And if I don't watch out, you know they're gonna get me too. Telephone, 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 telephone. Well, I strangled the cord, ripped it off of the phone. And I saw the bone, and I saw the twinkling lights. And it must have been rats, cause it sure was a drone. Sure was a drag. Paper and wire killed my brother and my sister too. And if you don't watch out, you know they're gonna get you. And if I don't watch out, you know they're gonna get me too. Telephone, telephone, telephone.
Cop check.
Joining me today on The Culture Catch is the critically acclaimed theatrical producer and performance art impresario, Mr. Mark Russell.
Howdy.
Mark, welcome to The Culture Catch.
Thank you.
Tell us about yourself. How did you land in New York City?
Oh, that's a long story. I was in school and I had a Polish mentor, and so I went to Poland as sort of a graduation thing out of the University of Texas. And on my way home, I stopped in New York and I just kept going. So I kind of... And it took me a long time to make it back to Texas.
Were you always involved in the theatrical end, the performance
always,
art?
I came to New York to be a theater director. I ended up directing a theater. I directed Performance Space 122 for about 21 years.
And how did that? How do you stay on a gig that long?
It's you burn out, and then you burn back in, and you burn out, and you burn back in. And I had a great job. I had the best job in New York City for a long time.
What was it about the space? How did that collective come together? Many people don't know the legendary status that are not from New York.
Maybe it's an abandoned school that some artists sort of squatted and then turned into kind of an institution, and it was rolling along. And their own careers started taking off when it was Tim Miller and Charlie Moulton and Charles Dennis. And they thought I knew more about business than they did at the moment, so they turned it over to me. And I... realized they didn't have books or real 501c3 status. And so anyway, I sort of helped put the place together, and we kept rolling. It was good.
What were the biggest challenges early on with the space?
Well, the biggest challenges always are funding a thing like that. We went from a $40,000 budget to about $800,000 budget in about 4 years. But when I came on, they said, we have a salary for you for $7,000. I thought, oh, that's pretty good. $150 a week. I can maybe do that. And then I realized that that included what I would make on unemployment. So I got into fundraising really fast.
Yeah, yeah. Who were some of your earliest patrons?
Oh, you know, the patrons were actually the artists. The people like Eric Bogosian and a lot of folks like that. Philip Glass. Those are the people that were helping support us in the beginning. And we used to do these big benefits, marathon benefits, took 3 or 4 days, and we'd have like 60 artists in 5 days, going crazy.
Any memorable weekends?
Oh, too many, too many. You know, sitting on an American flag with Allen Ginsberg on stage, because we needed to hold down the corners of the flag. Well, Ann Carlson did a dance about America.
Wow.
on the flag. It was
intense. What year was that?
God, it was maybe 1990, something like that.
Right, right. Anything else?
First performances of Karen Finley. Amazing performances.
Now, were those the legendary Yam performances?
Yeah.
I mean, isn't it that's sad that people gravitate towards that aspect who don't know Karen and know how talented she is?
Well, but Karen, you know, really touches a sort of a primal place with her voice and in her poetry, and that's what's overlooked because of she may be naked while she's doing it or waving candied yams around or doing something outrageous to get your attention, but then she hits you with this intense story that will change your life if you don't watch out.
And then she gets co-opted to Lincoln Center And, you know, as many of your performance artists did.
Yeah, well. A lot of them moved on. I mean, John Leguizamo did a lot of time with us and went to Broadway and films and everything. And the Blue Man Group had a lot to do with our beginnings. And now they're a multi-million-dollar corporation.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about the Blue Man Group because they went from you guys to
La Mama,
where I saw them originally, and then to that space where they are to this day.
Yeah.
And that's quite impressive for a group that was considered very experimental in the early days and maybe very tough for the average critic to embrace.
But
not New York critic, mind
you. Yeah. But, well, the New York critics embraced them, and then it just followed. I mean, when you realize that you could even bring your kids to this,
right,
even though it was performance art, and it was making performance art sort of available to a wider audience, and it was fun. So they it's natural that they took off. It's natural they took off. But they were also really determined guys. The three guys worked their butts off and were constantly talking about and tweaking that character of the Blue Man.
Right.
And we did a lot of touring with the Blue Man. That's where they invented the toilet paper things and all that. And we would come into a city and they'd say, Mark, we want to do something different. And it's with this, we want to cover the audience and toilet paper at the end. Okay.
I didn't realize that you guys toured Blue Man early on.
Yeah.
So that obviously helped fund the space as well.
We used to have a thing called the PS-122 field trips where I'd take three or four artists, like Danny Hawk, the Blue Man Group, and other folks out on the road and bring them to an audience that didn't know anything about performance. And everyone did about 10, 20 minutes. And it was a good way to expose them to touring and to the audiences. And it built an audience for this type of work out there.
What were the most engaged audiences outside of the traditional theater cities like San Francisco, L.A.?
You know, the best audience was in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Really?
They brought us back constantly, and they embraced everything. I found audiences out there in the Midwest, people are hungry for this stuff. If you allow them to, they'll tell you what they think. They'll have their own opinions. What happens is they think, oh, this is avant-garde. I can't have an opinion. I haven't studied dance or I haven't studied performance art. And actually, does it work for you or not? And what is your real response? And that's legitimate. That's
right.
What we were about. So it helped build an audience for that, and it was great.
Was Spalding already happening before?
He was already happening. He started out in 79, 80 doing the solo things. But he would come towards the middle of his career there. He started coming to PS-122 to try things out on our audience. And then eventually built things like Morning, Noon, and Night on our audience. You know, doing it on Sundays and Monday nights with a crowd. That eventually he would bring it uptown to Lincoln Center.
Right. And Eric as well. Eric said, and I have to read this quote, I think it's wonderful, that you are a genius at finding the awkward new stuff, the gems and diamonds no one's noticed yet. If the artist is the antenna of the race, then Mark is the antenna of the antenna. That's terrific.
I had to pay him a lot for that.
I was going to say, what a front man.
Yeah.
What was it about Eric? I saw many of his shows. What was it that just was so riveting the first time you saw Eric?
Well, he was channeling all these American characters, these real American characters, and getting to the dark part of the American heart that we don't want to admit. So he would go into a room, our room often, and he'd close the door, put on his tape recorder, and he'd, you know, find his inner racist and find that dialogue that was coming out. And then he and his wife put them together in these great collage pieces where they would bounce out up against each other. And it was quite a critique of liberal and conservative, a really interesting, amazing voice, a good storyteller, too.
It was Annie Sprinkle part of the scene?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Annie, I saw a few of her shows, but it was through the kitchen. Now, were you guys doing shows with the kitchen?
No, she first came up through Franklin Furnace and then the kitchen and then later did some stuff for us.
Right. When you would audition talent, what was your criteria back then?
Well, I never really auditioned. I would go out and see things. I saw things like seven nights a week, two
Good
or three
for you.
Things a night. And And then I would invite them to bring in something new. If I thought someone had something, and sometimes I got loads of videotapes, and I watched those as well, but if I felt someone had something, then I'd say, here, I have a weekend, these are the resources we can give you, here's a fee, try it out. And it was a luxury, actually, that we could have this laboratory for experimental work, theater, dance, music, whatever, and we could be there just for the experiment of it. Right. And our audience was there. Our audience wanted to be challenged, and right. That was a great thing about PS-122, still continuing today.
Right. So the glory years were, what, like the mid-80s, early 90s, would you say?
Yeah, from like 85 to 95, for sure, is the hot spot.
Right.
You know, there were different generations that would go in, and each one sort of felt like they owned the place, and that was great. That was another good thing about this vessel called PS-122, this abandoned school. It was a really crap theater, actually. But it had really good, we used to call it theater dust. And we were reflecting a artistic community that was reflecting the needs and the ideas of America. So that was coming through there. The whole AIDS, ACT UP, all of that stuff coming through. Then also the memorials. Then also the outrageous, ridiculous theater people after the Ridiculous closed, people like Ethel Eigelperger and all the club people from around, you know.
I wanted to ask you about the club connections. Yeah. People forget how vital the club scene was and the art scene was in the East Village in those years. And it really helped gentrify that neighborhood. You could almost make the argument PS-122 was maybe the antenna for helping galvanize.
Actually, it's interesting because in the heart of the time when the galleries were so cool.
Yeah.
We were ignored. We were working too hard.
Really?
Yeah. Like the Fun Gallery was right in back of us.
Ah.
But we weren't part of that scene. They'd have maps of the East Village galleries. We weren't on it. And because dancers are working too hard and they don't have a lot of money and,
right.
You know. But it sort of rolled along so that eventually we were part of that. There were a lot of clubs, the 8BC, Avenue A.
8BC without the ceiling. I love that place.
Yeah. It was just the best. And so a lot of the people like Karen Finley, Ethel Eichelberger, developed their works there. And then PS-122 is where they took them to a wider audience.
Right, right.
It wasn't at 3 a.m. in the morning.
And how about the challenges when funding gets cut during administrations? How much did that affect you? I mean, those must be nightmare stories.
Those were nightmare stories.
Yeah.
Those were nightmare stories. It was a lot of stress. There was a lot of times when... me and my managing director would decide that we wouldn't pay ourselves for the month because we needed to keep the place open. So I skipped a lot of checks
right.
in the middle of the 90s just to keep the doors open. And it's very tough.
Right.
We were lucky that we crawled our way out of each one of those crises.
The artists always seem to come back to help save the franchise, if it would be.
Yeah.
You know, if they believe in the space, and obviously...
They do. It's the space has a resilience because it's built by artists with artists, and so it'll follow there. And they're the best entrepreneurs I know, and the most inventive entrepreneurs. So, you know, we would do 4 shows a night sometimes just to get the box office income to make up for the grant we had lost from the National Endowment for the Art.
Right.
And kept working that way.
So you finally decide to strike out on your own? Was it other factors that you care to share?
No, it's a complex story, but I retired in 1904.
And it's short-lived.
Yeah. It was a good time for me to move. And because I have a young son and I'd moved out the Upper West Side, a few other things.
The suburbs.
Yeah, the suburbs. And also, I was looking for some challenges. I wanted to get outside the four columns. And I had a couple chances to do these festivals, one of them being the Under the Radar Festival, we're going to talk about later. But they were great opportunities for me as a curator.
Well, let's talk it. Why don't we go right into the Under the Radar?
Sure.
How did that happen? How did you happen upon the festival? Were you brought in by outsiders, or did you help form the festival?
Well, there was this dialogue going on, supported by the Mellon Foundation and the Duke Foundation. And the Duke Foundation were supporters of us, and a woman named Olga Garay who has just left the Duke Foundation, was a very champion of mine and a great instigator. And they were working at getting this field of experimental theater or contemporary theater that is not existing or not penetrating the bigger presenters or the regional theaters. It's almost like the U.S. has two different theaters. There's the theater world with a capital T neon, and then there's this underground thing that's going on that I felt was closer to the heart of what was going on in young people and in the minds of America. And it was quicker to respond. Often, though, it wasn't made like regular theater. It was made by collaborations, by groups, or by independent artists that were funding their own thing, putting their own money up, directing their own scripts. They made them to tour often, and they funded them by getting a couple art centers to put in money. And so they would make it on tour and then tour to survive. And this is happening globally. So a couple years ago, they started these discussions, these conferences, with regional theater people and presenters and artists going, you know, look at this world. And there are a lot of discussions, and it's actually two very, very different cultures going on. And finally, I was one of the people that was saying, well, let's show some of this work. Like, we can talk about it theoretically a lot, but you really don't know until you've met it. So we started last year. We did the sort of the national version, and we did it out at Arts at St. Anne's.
Right.
And we brought like four or five groups together and did a very intensive weekend festival. Actually, its first impulse was for professionals, but I opened it up to, because all these people were coming through town, opened it up to the regular public. Now, this year, we've brought it to the public theater, and we're doing international theater. And we've got six shows at the public and seven shows outside of it that are some of the cream of the crop of experimental international theater.
Walk me through that submission process. That must be incredibly daunting.
It's
especially in an international market or international canvas.
I did a lot of traveling. You know, I became a road hog and sort of was going to a lot of festivals, talking to a lot of contacts I have around the world, seeing a lot of videotape, getting a lot of suggestions from my other compadres. And so we were able to put something together. And I was able to bring in some things that I've been wanting to bring to the city for a long time.
Tell us about some of the plays. Do you mind?
We have a group coming in, Superamas. And I first saw them in Bergen, Norway. And
how do you end up in Bergen, Norway?
It took a lot of drugs. Anyway, and there was this little festival in Bergen, Norway. And I go and I see this group, Superamas, they're based in Austria, but they're all French, and they get their money from France and Austria. And they're more a visual art or a multidisciplinary group of five guys, basically. And they are running the tech on stage and very inventive and a little bit very provocative as far as just many different things. The first show I saw actually had a real Nissan SUV, brand new, on stage, and the whole show turned into a Nissan commercial by the end of it. And it also included a complete recreation of I Want to Praise You by Fatboy Slim.
Right.
The MTV thing.
Yeah.
They did an exact recreation.
With the fly wires and everything.
Yeah. Oh,
extraordinary.
It's crazy, crazy. So they have really, they're more serious than that. But this particular piece, the second piece, their big piece they've made called Big Two, Show Business, one of the core texts is the movie Zoolander. And they also include the participation of a real French Airways stewardess.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, they have to work around her schedule.
I was going to say, how does one schedule performances?
Yeah.
So she's clearing some time in advance for the festival.
Yeah.
And it begins
January
19th.
They're one of the first groups we show, and it goes until the 23rd. It's a very short period of time.
Is there any chance that maybe one of these shows would be spun off and brought into another house, or maybe a semi
There's possibilities.
Run at the public?
Yeah, I'm. There's possibilities, but you know that would take. That's not our point, actually, and we are hoping that someone will come and see these things. And if something really strikes a chord with an audience, yeah, we hope to take it on. But I think most of this stuff, you have to see it now.
Right.
It's about seeing it, and actually, you should see two or three things if you can.
Right.
Or all of them. We've got a group called Cassis. Two women run this particular company, and they're doing a show called Comer, which is about grief, but it's very humorous, and half of it is a movie that they shoot part of it before when they're moving into the city. Part of their load-in is completing part of this movie. So you watch the first part, and then you watch the second part, which is all film. There's a guy named William Yang from Australia, who's a fine art photographer. It's sort of like Spalding Gray with photography.
Right.
He tells these beautiful stories about, in this particular case, Aboriginal culture and the plight of the Aborigines in Australia and East and the German in immigrants as well. And then there's Tim Crouch, who's been to the city with this piece once before. It's called My Arm, and he's a solo performer from the UK.
Right.
And it's a wacky story about a kid that raises his right arm above his head and doesn't take it down.
Read about this, yeah. Or I've heard about this somewhere, yeah.
And it sort of like sends up performance art and the media world, and it's
interesting.
Very interesting.
Did you see the piece Google Whack?
No, Borman's I missed Google that. Whack. I heard it was really great.
That was interesting. That sounds like something that you would have latched onto if you had found it first.
That was it. It was already here and doing just fine without me.
Yeah.
The other thing that we're doing is one piece of performance art that happens one day only on Friday, the 20th of January. And it's these two guys, Lone Twin is their name. And they are going to go throughout the day, starting around 9:30 in the morning, and collecting water throughout the city. And they may be collecting it from delis or from the East River or the West River, the Hudson, and bringing it back to the public theater. And in the process, now these guys look a little strange, so they sort of attract people as they go on their long walks.
Right.
And they collect stories from people and images. And then around 5 o'clock, they meet together and create a story or a performance that they do at 6 o'clock, a little hour-long performance. And then it ends on the streets of New York with a sort of a special environmental moment.
I love it. Yeah. That's fantastic. Has it become more and more difficult with the real estate prices? I mean, you know, we have many friends between us who cannot afford to live in the city,
yeah,
which is very sad. How does one even approach off-Broadway anymore with that squeeze?
It's really tough. It's down to the trust fund babies if you want to live in New York.
Yeah.
And it's decimated the artistic scene in the East Village. And sometimes you feel like the East Village is becoming a parody of itself, or sort of the Disney version. I think Manhattan's turning into the Disney version. And it's tough to survive. It's now even tougher to survive if you're in Brooklyn to do this. And it's having an effect on the art scene here. It's still a very, very vibrant scene. A lot of young people come here and try to make it and go. Where it hurts is in those artists that have begun to make a body of work and they just can't continue it on mom's money and peanut butter sandwiches anymore.
Right.
You know?
Well put.
And which sometimes is about the depth of the work begins to suffer. On the other hand, a lot of these artists, like in this festival now, is a guy named Richard Maxwell. And he's doing a piece at the Kitchen that he was already going to do at the Kitchen. We were sort of umbrellaing it in just to give him a little extra boost. He's an amazing major artist in the U.S. He's like Sam Shepard. The way he looks at theater is very unique. And what he makes is very unique. It's challenging work. And he's been able to make his career work by getting some New York attention, but then building it overseas and with commissions from Berlin and Amsterdam and other places. So here's a guy that isn't being presented by the public or even, well, he was presented once by BAM or Manhattan Theater Club, but is one of our major artists in the U.S. right now, but kind of unknown.
Yeah.
And existing and traveling and doing his work under the radar of the American theater. A lot of those theater people will say, well, do you know what the whom Richard Maxwell is? They say, oh, I've heard about him, but I've never seen his work. There's a whole movement now, sort of a fringe theater. Every little city is starting a fringe. But this is slightly different work,
right,
what we're doing. I'm trying to do something that's going to raise your skirt a little. And a lot of the fringe work is a more about like trying to become the next Urinetown.
Right. I hear you.
And so that's the struggle. It's there are some amazing things that have come out of the fringe, but it's a different approach. It's maybe more of a 90s approach now to how do you support yourself as an artist.
Right. Now, you're getting back to Under the Radar and some of the pieces, and not having seen them, I'm just throwing this out. It would seem to me that a lot of the nanotechnology really affords incredible co-opting of technology and creativity like nowhere before, and it's so affordable now that maybe an artist couldn't afford the equipment,
mm-hmm,
to use the video equipment.
Well, almost every one of the pieces we're going to show is using video, some more sophisticated, some less.
And interfacing with computers and,
yeah,
and you know, these laptop computers are incredible, what you can slave to.
Yeah, you can bring the laptop in and run your whole show off your iMac. You know, it's crazy.
Yeah.
You know, I forgot to tell you about one of the most interesting pieces, which is from Brazil. It's a company called Company dos Atores. And they're doing rehearsal.hamlet, which is their updating of Hamlet's story. And it's outrageous. It's pretty, everyone at some point, everyone becomes Ophelia. At some point, everyone does the to be or not to be speech.
Right.
And they're doing it with, you know, plastic bags on their head and all sorts of outrageous stuff. I think Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are two ninja characters. So that's one of the things I'm really proud to be bringing in. It has, most of these things have not been seen in the States.
That's amazing. Could this be brought on the road?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So you've packaged it, if you got the funding together, that you could...
Yeah, it actually wouldn't cost that much to go in, and we have been looking at bringing it to college environments or something of that sort, where you,
right,
can take... It is expensive, and it's to bring this size of a thing, and,
right,
it's technologically... it's be a Normandy invasion. But... But it works.
Oh, you know, maybe Apple. Who knows? Maybe find out, you know, a patron right here, since we're giving them shameless plugs.
There we go.
What do you do to unwind, Mark? I mean, you're taking in all of this culture all the time. Do you have a chance to read for pleasure or to listen to music for pleasure?
Oh,
do you,
yeah,
get to decompress that way, or would you rather be a monk and get into your, you know?
I have my own practice. You know, I sort of write and draw and that kind of thing. That relaxes me. And my wife pulls me away on vacations and enforces me not to use my computer. So that's great. And I have a 2.5-year-old, so it's I'm got to be pay attention.
A whole new world.
Yeah, whole new world that way.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of people interrupting and keeping me in the real life. That's great. I love it. It's and it enriches when I go out and see work and how I make this bigger picture.
Right.
I've been sort of lucky enough and blessed enough to be able to go around the world looking at work for the possibility of bringing it to different communities, and so it's a great challenge and a great mission.
I forgot to ask you, getting back to the public, and it's its 50th anniversary. How crucial was it to make that connection with them? Did they seek you out?
A bit. It was sort of mutual. I was looking for a place. I wanted to take this festival, which is pretty radical for the American theater, and bring it into the center of the American theater, and that's the public theater. And they have a lot of theaters there, about 5-6 theaters. And I wanted to... bring it there and have, so it would, a lot of theater people think, oh, that only happens at BAM or it only happens at PS122. I'm glad they do that, but I it's not my thing.
Right.
So I'm hoping to get more converts. I'm hoping more people will open up to this work and that the public theater itself will open up to this work. And Oscar Eustace, who's running the theater now, is a friend from a long time ago, from 1977. I think he wants to find a place for it as well. So we're having a grand time there.
Good for you. Congratulations to everyone involved. How does one fix Broadway or off-Broadway? I know that's a daunting question, but I'd like to hear your opinion.
Well, you know, it's not my job.
But if he was hired as a Broadway think tank.
You know, the way I go after it is by trying to make a place for people like the Blue Man Group that are now, you know, dominating Vegas and Toronto and Chicago, make a place for that kind of work to develop. And you never know how it's going to happen.
Right.
You never know who is the next Twyla Tharp or the next Jonathan Larson, you know. And that this is the soup where it happens. And it's a very labor-intensive, non-remunerative process. But every once in a while, you'll find someone with it and a message that needs to reach a larger audience. And Broadway actually, you know, if it's going to make money, they're ready for it.
Yeah, well.
And so they'll tap someone like Julie Taymor, who grew up at La Mama and in the streets of New York.
See, people don't know that about Julie.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they see the Broadway or Twyla, and they've seen on Broadway, but they don't know the roots and where they've started, or even Tom O'Horgan.
Yeah.
Who did Hair and all these other radical plays.
Yeah, they don't, a lot of these people, this, where they cut their teeth was downtown.
Right.
And when I ran into Julie, and she doesn't remember me, we're not friends, but I mentioned that I saw one of her first pieces in Soho when she first came to the city, and she was like, oh my goodness. She's working on a movie now, which is based with the Beatles songs, with like Bono playing Ken Kesey and Eddie Izzard singing Mr. Kite. It's going to be outrageous.
Now, Eddie, did he do any 122 shows?
Yes.
I love Eddie.
One of those stories.
Yeah.
Eddie Izzard had, he was playing 2,000-seat houses on the West End in London, but he wanted to break into the U.S. And someone said to him, Eddie, the way to go into the U.S. is, again, sort of under the radar. So you should play this place, PS 122. So he came over, and from a 2,000-seat house, he played a 100-seat house in our basement, our smallest theater. For $15. Sort of like getting, if you went to a bar and they said, oh, Robin Williams is only $20 inside. And so we were packing him out, and he had a grand time, but New Yorkers discovered him for themselves. It wasn't like his producers coming in. They could have put him right on Broadway and everyone would have gone, who is this guy? You know, what's he about?
Right. There was no Barker.
No.
That's great when that happens. Is there any historical play that you would love to mount with your head and where it is and what you've been involved in? And pulling,
well, you know, I started as
elements.
A theater director, and I've got my list.
Oh, I'm curious.
But, I'd like to try Lear. That's, you know, before I die at some point, that would be something. I don't think it would look like regular Lear's.
Oh, we hope not.
You know, at one point I wanted to do a lip sync. Have someone sample all the versions of recordings of Lear or something, or the Shakespeare's, and then make a lip sync Lear. It's probably been done already. But,
I doubt it. I doubt it. You're giving it away.
So you could, like, you know, mouth the Gilgard lines.
Right. What's the next Hair or Rent? You see anything on the horizon that's bubbling under that?
If I could tell you that, you'd have to kill me.
Well, you'd be the producer, Mark.
Yeah.
You'd be attached.
I always have hopes, and there's people all over the place with high hopes. Every one of these shows, you go, you know, maybe this would be the one that would break through.
Mm-hmm.
One of the nice things about the public right now is they're not necessarily, they're just trying to make good theater, and they know it's going to be picked up. And getting back to really looking at, let's do some quality theater here. And then if it's right to reach a wider audience, it will. Right. And so I can't tell you. I mean, it might be Super Ramas.
Mm-hmm.
The guys are smart enough.
Right.
And it's now enough. And it can certainly, a lot of people can relate to it. So maybe it's Super Ramas.
All right, you're hearing it here first. It's in the digital domain. What new projects after Under the Radar? Or will that take you into next year? Is it becoming...
Well, we're hoping that we get funding for 2 more years. There's a funder that's interested in perhaps doing that with us so that we can do it for 2 more years at least. And maybe by that time we'll have built it into an institution that can keep on going.
Right.
But I'm the guest artistic director of the PICA Time-Based Arts Festival, which is out in Portland, Oregon. So it's a PICA TBA festival, and it's every September, and I'm doing 06 and 07.
Wow.
And so we take over a whole city and do performance art.
And people forget about Ashland, Oregon, being this great Shakespeare center.
Right.
So there's a lot of incredible...
Portland is an amazing... Yeah. I don't know if you've ever been there.
I made it to Ashland, but I didn't make it that far north.
It's an incredible city. Somehow they managed to limit it from becoming a sprawl, becoming Seattle.
Right.
And it has a lot of small-town charm and heat, and there's so many... It's liberal heaven.
Right.
There's so many crazies and burners there, and the audience just is, again, really hungry for some fresh work.
Right.
And they really pick up on it and support it and ask very interesting questions. It's a great place to develop work.
Is Portland the next epicenter maybe for an art scene to happen? You know, we've had Seattle's happen. New York is always happening. But is it vital enough that it could support something that would be an epicenter for maybe under the radar theater?
I think Portland's place in the ecology will be to be like the festival you have to go to.
Right.
Every September.
Right.
Internationally, because they're already getting a lot of international guests coming there, going, what is happening in the U.S.? It's really hard to penetrate the U.S. and figure out what is coming out. This is so much flotsam, you know, our Coke commercials. So what are people really making down there?
Right.
And so that's what Time-Based Arts Festival is about, and that's what Under the Radar is going to be about.
Great. Well, it's great to know that we have some vital theater that's being championed by some people with deep pockets. It's always important to have the patrons with the artists.
Yes. Well, this stuff is, it takes money to do it. It is not one of those things that pays for itself in the old American capitalist way. It is culture, and it's meant for wider audiences, but it just costs too much to do, to pay the people to show up,
right,
to turn on the lights. So we've also kept the ticket prices for Under the Radar way low. You can see everything for $60.
Every single piece.
Almost every piece for $60.
That's incredible.
Or $25 a show, which is pretty cheap itself.
That's incredible.
So.
Wow. Hats off to you getting that done. That's phenomenal. What advice do you have for the young struggling actor who may be thinking, or the performance artist who may feel like, God, I just don't know if I can get it together for something. You know, how do you keep them going?
If you're fresh out of school and you're trying to crack into this scene, it is about keeping it going and about knowing that we need you more than you need us, actually. It's more about being a partner to these people. And that supposedly have control. Don't give them control over your fate. If they aren't catching on to what you're doing, do it in your kitchen and do it somewhere else, or make your own space and kick their ass. That's what it's about. And that's the American way. and it's if you believe in it strong enough, and it's a test. This is where everyone talks about paying your dues as sort of a romantic idea. No, this is it. This is like, no, I'm really going to put most of my paycheck towards trying to mount this piece, because I know that the next one I might be able to get funding for the next one, and this is what I have to say. And that's what I suggest. And also, you don't necessarily have to do it in New York anymore. You can do it in Austin, Texas. Philadelphia is a really happening scene. Portland, Oregon's a really happening scene. These are communities that can really support you with cheaper rents and a different kind of lifestyle, and an audience that's hungry for this work. People are really, now in this multi-information age and this blitz age, people are really hungry for that real experience that you can get with an audience of 50 to 100 people, where they're not mic'd necessarily, or the issues are what you share with that audience. You just can't touch that experience.
Fantastic, Mark. Very encouraging. Very encouraging. Well, I wish you success with Under the Radar and your future endeavors.
Thanks a lot.
And we want to thank you for being on the Culture Catch.
Thank you very much. Take care.
I'd like to thank today's sponsors, WebHSP, for all of your web hosting needs. It's webhsp.com. And our friends at Final Draft, and now Final Draft AV, the only multi-column scriptwriting software for podcasts, videocasts, commercials, DV shorts, documentaries, you name it. It's Final Draft. This is Dusty Wright for the Culture Catch. Converge is the word.